Welcome back. That's, of course, Burning and Looting by the Wailers. Bunny Wailer of the Wailers, born on this day in 1947. This is a good music day. We'll see if it'll be a good day in the state legislature. Charles Robinson, who covers Annapolis for Maryland Public Television, is with us in the House.
I'm heading back there.
Of course you are.
As soon as I'm finished with you.
I don't know how to take that. But there are a lot of issues here facing people who are disenfranchised in our society. And there's been a shield law. We've talked about this program before. We'll talk about in this segment. There are laws regarding the right of felons to vote. There are 40,000 men and women in this state who are disenfranchised and in Maryland. And that is what we're going to talk about and more. We are joined here now in the studio along with Charles Robinson, Diamante Brown, director. Did I say that correctly, right?
No, Diamante.
I'm so sorry, okay. Diamante. Diamante Brown, who is director of Out for Justice and co-chair of Unlock the Vote Coalition. Tony Holness, who is public policy director for ACLU of Maryland.
Morning.
Morning. Perry Hopkins, advocate and community organizer of Communities United.
Good morning.
And at the end of the table?
John Comer. I'm the lead organizer for Maryland Communities United.
John Comer. Okay, so that wasn't on my list. I apologize. So, folks, welcome. Good to have you all with us. 410-319-8888 is the number. So, Diamante, tell us the status of what's going on.
Well, we're waiting for the governor to sign a bill. Once it gets to the governor, we're just asking for his signature.
Which bill are we talking about?
We're talking about Senate Bill 340, House Bill 980, voting rights bill for ex-felons. The bill has passed out of both chambers. And now we are very, very, very hopeful and urging the governor to sign a bill when it comes across his desk.
So this is the bill that the Corey McCrae bill that went through from the House of Delegates and others that put in. That was passed by both House and Senate.
Yes, Delegate McCrae put in a House bill and Senator Conway put in the Senate bill.
So I'm curious what you think before we turn to other two guests here Well, let me just go to Tony first and go to Perry and John and come right back to you.
All right.
Tony, what do you think the politics of this is now that all of a sudden this has shifted? Is it a Republican governor that allows the shift?
Well, Mark, before I answer your question, I have to make mention of I have to do my due diligence and give credit to the broad and really diverse coalition of folks that have been working on this effort. You have three of us on today, but really we are, I think, the tip of the iceberg. There are national organizations, including DEMOS, the Sentencing Project, the Brennan Center, as well as local organizations, the NAACP and Communities United. And I would be remiss not to mention our fearless leader, Jane Henderson, who has really been taking the charge. To your question of what's going to really tip the scales and have this legislation actually take effect, right now, like Diamante said, we're really waiting for the governor to put pen to paper and sign this piece of legislation. It's passed both chambers, and it's really just waiting for his approval. And I expect, or at least we are hopeful, that the governor will be supportive. And the governor, Hogan, has shown, I think, a commendable commitment to a fair and democratic electoral process, particularly through his support for campaign finance reform. And so I think he recognizes the importance of safeguarding the political voice of everyone, but especially the voice of marginalized communities. And SB 340 really falls within, I think, the same ilk of reform. And the reason for that is, you know, we have to be candid about who we're talking about. Here in Maryland, there are 65,000-plus individuals who are disenfranchised. And the majority of those people are African-American. 41,000-plus are African-American. So this policy that we have of currently disenfranchising individuals who have a felony conviction had a clear disproportionate impact on African Americans. And so, I do think the governor will be supportive. We're hopeful that he will be supportive. We encourage any supporters of this legislation to reach out to him and let him know how important it is.
So I'm curious, let me go to John and then Perry, what you think the political outcome of this will be. Let's say that this bill actually is signed by the governor. I think there's indications he will probably sign it. What comes next? Because this bill has huge political implications, I think, in terms of voting, in terms of who, in terms of power, if it's ever organized.
Well, ideally, for Communities United, we would go into beginning to seek out ex-offenders and getting them registered to vote and turning them out to the polls. So we've been working with ex-offenders and recruiting ex-offenders throughout Baltimore and some MPG County for the past 6 months on this issue. So we want to make sure that we're not just passing this law and it just sits on the books, that we actually exercise our right to vote and make an impact.
Also,
let me get you into the mic there.
Oh, excuse me. Also, I'll say good morning, everyone. Also, in my experience, personal experience, as well as my interaction with other ex-felons and ex-offenders who are unable to vote right now, there's a lot of excitement. A lot of people are looking forward to being able to exercise their participation in a democratic process. There are a lot of people who really want to take part in their society, as well as this country's decisions. In quite a few areas where people are being disfranchised, there are laws and policies in place now that they don't even have the ability to vote against. And they're looking forward to being heard, to being recognized, to participating.
So let me ask you first, just a technical thing to pull that mic closer to you. There we go. Now we got your voice where it needs to be. So, Charles, let me get back here. You've been covering this for years. I mean, this is, you know, while we see what happens with lawyers at bail, mm-hmm. with the power of bail bondsmen and the power of certain industries blocking this kind of legislation, yet we're seeing legislation like this, which used to be an anathema to most people, the idea mm-hmm. of felons having a right to vote, moving ahead. What do you think the politics?
This is probably the most vociferous debate that we had this session.
This particular bill.
But this bill. And let me talk about how opponents tried to attack this bill in several different ways. Well, first of all, they brought up the fact that, well, you know, if a felon may confront, you know, people that they have accosted by a heinous murderer, or is they that's how they described it, a heinous murderer may see a family of somebody, and of course that was defeated. Then there was a question of whether or not a rape victim would see the person who committed a crime against them. This ginned up the emotions within, at least in the House, and partly in the Senate, too. I think the one that was really kind of that came out of left field, and it came from Pat McDonough. And those of you who know Pat McDonough is a Republican. He's from out of Harford in Baltimore County. He said, well, let's just open the gates. He says, you know, let's just put polling places inside of jails. Now, it was a very absurd amendment, but it got a lot of people's attention. And I think the irony was it failed. And I jokingly told him afterwards, why didn't you act like a preacher and said, can I get an amen on this? He said, well, you know, as he told me, he said, Charles, there is no religion in this body, which is kind of, you know, weird. But then I said, well, I guess if you had said that, you probably would have got more than one vote. He said, Charles, even I didn't vote for this. So, and what that says to me is that people were using a lot of absurd tactics. Now, I know a lot of you are hoping that the governor signs this bill. I don't expect the governor to sign this bill.
Well, let's leave it there. We're going to come right back. Let you pick up on this and let everybody come back to make this point and talk about where this might go. And that's an interesting point you made, because I haven't seen anywhere else. We'll see why you think that and what you all think where this is going to go, because this is on the verge of being one of the major political bill, and we've seen how people have reacted to it, which I'll talk about in a moment with our guests. So we're going to take a very quick break. I'm going to tell you how quick this is our news break, and come right back. Stay with us.
It's just an amp, like Michael, it's all expected. Things are for the looking. If you got the money, Quest is for the booking. Come on, everybody, let's get with the fly mode. Still got room on the truck load of black.
Everybody's doing a brand new dance now.
The Locomotion by the wonderful Eva. We pay that today, of course, because she passed away on this day in 2003 from cervical cancer and gave us much joy while she was alive. We are joined here in studio. Charles Robinson stays with us for the next few minutes before he dashes off to Annapolis and Washington. The MPT's Annapolis correspondent, Diamante Brown is with us in studio, who is director of Out for Justice and co-chair of Unlock the Vote Coalition. Tony Holness joins us by phone, public policy associate for the ACLU of Maryland. Perry Hopkins is in the House, advocate and community organizer at Communities United, along with John Comer, who is lead organizer for Communities United. And y'all at 410-319-8888. We're going to come to your calls in just a minute. But we left off here with the political battle around this. So, and I'm curious, before Charles, you come back in and talk about what you think the governor won't sign. I guess your perspectives, and we'll start here with Diamante and jump over to Perry and hear Tony and get to the phones. What was your experience in this political battle? Because it was, as Charles said, it was a real vociferous battle on the floor, with people using terminology on the floor like when they opposed this, to not saying the opposition were not community justice advocates, but were criminal advocates. And one of the headlines reading, "Lawbreakers getting a second chance." So tell me about what you experienced in all this.
Well, to put it simply, people are mean. I think that a lot of times when people are empowered, they feel that they can say whatever they want to whomever they want and not have to worry about how that makes another person feel, because whether someone committed a crime, they're still human. And one of the things that I wanted to mention is that we're talking about people that have already served their prison and jail sentences. They're on parole and probation, but the core mission of parole and probation is to help people transition from the prisons and the jail into the community successfully. And even parole and probation have stated that one of the most successful ways to reintegrate someone is by civic engagement. And voting is one of the top ways to engage someone civically, and also it increases public safety. So on one hand, we have legislators talking about public safety and let's make sure that we're always concerned about the victims. But on the other hand, they're not talking about what does public safety really mean and how do we get to public safety? Because I think we can all see that locking people up is not getting us anywhere. Actually, we have higher crime rates. The more we lock people up, the worse crime gets. It's not getting any better. So we have to somehow, we want to be tough on crime, but is that the right solution?
Perry, and then we'll go to Tony.
Hi, Mark. You know, as to this issue of whether the governor will sign, I don't see any reason why he wouldn't or why he shouldn't, for that matter. You know, the national movement is moving in this direction. There are 14 other states that have taken this step, and allowed individuals to be reenfranchised and to be, you know, to really engage in society the way that we expect them to, the way that we hope they would, as Diamante said. And about, you know, and I can tell you the jurisdictions, it's D.C., Hawaii, I could list out 14, but, you know, in terms of how that changes the political landscape, I'm not even sure that it would really be a threat, for lack of a better word, to the Republican institution, because about half of the states that operate this way have elected a Republican governor. So, there's really, I don't think there's any good reason why the governor should not sign this piece of legislation. So that's I'll leave it there, but I look forward to hearing what everyone else thinks.
Harry.
I can only speak personally on this issue. I sit and I listen. This issue is really about the restoration of a basic civil right. The facts have shown there's an increase in recidivism when a returning citizen struggles within the reentry process. The reentry process in its completion is paramount to success. When I can't vote, when I can't participate, when I'm alienated to the process of reentering society, I have to pay taxes, I have to work, I have to stay lawful, I have to do everything that a citizen is supposed to do after serving my term of incarceration. I may not have completed my sentence, but the mechanism that we have in place, our justice system, it levies a fair and just penalty. Okay, the Division of Corrections says that I'm ready to reenter society at a certain point in my incarceration. And it's at that point we and I am due the ability to fully complete in that process.
So before we have to leave, I want to get to these phone calls coming in at 410-319-8888. Gary, we're going to come right to your call after this. But Charles, I know you have to run in a few minutes.
Sure.
Talk about why you think the politics of this, the governor, the argument that the governor will not sign. What is that argument?
I think you have to look at the governor's insistence in his supplemental budget. He's done three of them. In the second one, he put in money for 100 additional state troopers and the reopening of the Annapolis barracks. This is a law and order governor, whether you like him or not. And he is going to, if you will, be swayed by those law and order arguments. He isn't, you know, to describe Larry Hogan as a progressive, I don't think anybody is would agree with that. He is definitely a conservative. He is what I kind of call conservative light. In other words, I don't think he puts his finger up and tries to figure out which way the wind is blowing, but as much as he understands he's in a Democratic state and, you know, some things are going to fly and some things aren't. This is a state that has, you know, pretty much made a determination that let's make sure felons serve their entire terms. And there are conservative Democrats in this state who, while placating what I would call progressives, are kind of a little ticked off. And I think they are part of the group that helped put Larry Hogan in office. And the governor will justify it that, you know, we cannot. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I can see him saying this is not a bill that's good for the state. Whether you think it's good from a public policy standpoint, you got the votes, and I know the people in the room. When we were off the air, talked about do they have enough votes to override a governor's veto. And as I explained to the gentleman who's sitting next to me, remind yourself that the override doesn't come until 2016. That's a long time. And, those arguments that we heard on the floor against this bill, you're going to hear them out in the community.
So the argument – so let me be clear about the rules about that, so that if a bill is not signed by the governor –
It will be vetoed.
I'm saying vetoed.
Yes.
Then the veto cannot be overridden until the next legislative session.
Yes. It's the first piece of legislation that's taken up at when the session begins.
So I know you got to run. Thank you, Charles, for being with us.
No problem. Thank you, everyone.
Let me go to the phone show, 410-319-8888. As we're seeing the state of the bill put in by Cory McCray and others, Senator Conway, that would give felons the right to vote the moment they walk out of prison, even though they may still be on parole, have the right to vote at that moment, or probation, 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on this before we go back to our guest, 410-319-8888. Write to us here, talk@steinershow.org. And Gary, in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hi.
Good morning, Gary.
Good morning, Mark. This issue is historical and personal for me. My oldest son did the better part of about 10 years in prison. He's only 34 years old. And in Europe, they allow the incarcerated persons to vote.
The people in jail can vote in many countries in Europe, right, exactly.
Bingo, yes. And so, you have to look at the origins of this country where only white landowners could vote. So, obviously, this is a very important power that Congressman John Lewis, the civil rights hero and icon, called the most important nonviolent weapon that any of us have. And the pushback against voting rights for people of the working class, of the lower socioeconomic strata, the reasons why the folks with the wealth, the resources, and the power consistently try to stamp out, urinate, defecate, and spit upon is because this power of the people, just regular people, the overwhelming majority of people, can really change things for the better of ourselves and for the betterment of this entire planet. And when I listen to these stopgap measures, it's kind of like, for me, it's like kind of like, I'm drinking polluted water every day. And, you guys want to just like slowly clean my water. I need this water cleaned now.
Right.
And so I'm not going to go on, but I appreciate you allowing my input here. The, I'm wearing my Angela Davis T-shirt right now.
And we can't see that, but we can hear it. So this has been a really long struggle for you all in terms of advocating for this bill. And we had Corey McCray on here when he first introduced it, and it was kind of unlike a freshman delegate to kind of leap into the fray the way he leapt into the fray. But as he said, this affects a huge number of people who would be voters in his district. I wonder why you think about – John, we haven't had you talk in a few minutes, so let me just jump in here for a minute. Why you think that the why it's so difficult in the state of Maryland to make this happen, even though a majority of the House and the Senate did vote for it?
I don't think it's a problem that's just specific to Maryland. I believe that voting rights is a basic human right, and as the caller said previously, this is within the history of the United States of America. I think that within politics, many times, in order to get the people that you want in office, many times people will do whatever they can to, try to prevent the other side from voting, regardless of what side that may be. And, and we're not even talking about we're not even recognizing partisan or bipartisan politics in this conversation. But, when somebody can come out, serve time, come out and pay taxes, but they're not allowed to vote, there's a microscope that needs to be put on that to figure out exactly what's going on and what part of the oppression platform that this serves.
Tony, let me bring you back in here before we kind of run out of time in the segment to get everybody had kind of closing thought about where they think this is going and the work they've been doing. Because it does sound like this may be really rough to get the governor to sign, and I'm curious, but your sense of what the tenor of the legislature was for all this?
Sure, and Mark, the caller mentioned looking to Europe as a good example of a jurisdiction in which everyone has the right to vote. But we don't even really need to look that far. In Maine and Vermont, everyone can vote, even while they're in prison. So
even while they're in prison, in Maine and Vermont, that I didn't know.
And so, this idea, it's really not so radical. When Delegate McDonough introduced the amendment, I think it was to put voting machines in prisons. I know, it was meant in jest and it was
right,
sort of
right.
A joke, but I thought it was a good idea. I don't.
Me
see why
too,
not.
Tony.
And it's all closed there, Mark. I do think the governor does recognize, this is a governor who used the public campaign finance fund to get elected. He recognizes, I think he should recognize the importance of marginalized voices and creating an opportunity for those voices to be heard, and that's exactly what this bill does. So I'm hopeful that he'll support it.
Diamante, and then we'll come back to prayer before we close out.
Well, this type of legislation falls right in line with what Michelle Alexander calls the new Jim Crow, and time after time, people find ways to disenfranchise black people. First, it was we just couldn't vote just because we were black. Then we had to pass literacy tests despite the fact that we didn't have the proper education to pass the literacy test to vote. Now, it's no secret that the majority of people that are incarcerated are black people. And so, and the majority are felons. And so now, we won't just come out and say, we don't want your vote, and it's because it's a black thing. But we can't deny the root of the problem. And it's no secret that most of the people that we're talking about are black. So once again, we're not just suppressing the ex-felon vote. We're suppressing the black vote.
A closing thought, Perry.
Well, Diamond Table, you're absolutely right. This is a way of voter suppression. Everybody knows it. It's a civil issue. It's not a criminal issue. It's not about public safety. This legislation will have an important and positive impact on our lives. The ex-offender is not a half a citizen, even though upon returning to society, he's only given back half his civil rights. This is about us having a real stake in the community. It's about the return of our full citizenship as we are expected to maintain that responsibility from the time we have finished our part of our incarceration.
We'll see where this winds out, and I'm very curious to see how this ends up, and we'll continue this conversation with you all and also hope in the coming months to have folks from Out for Justice and Communities United join us for other conversations that affect the larger community and have your voices at the table, because I'm glad you all are in here. Both your groups do really incredible work, as do the ACLU, but we all know that. They're on the show a lot. I just want to say that your two organizations do a great deal of work, and they need to be recognized in the community and brought out more. So we look forward to having you all on here more as we have these conversations about where our future goes.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us, Mark.
Tony Holness, you just heard, Public Policy Associate for ACLU of Maryland. Always great to have you with us.
And thank you so much.
Diamante Brown, Director of Out for Justice, a really important organization and co-chair of Unlock the World Coalition, and the two folks here from Communities United, Perry Hopkins, advocate and community organizer, and John Comer, who is their lead organizer. Good to have all three of you in the studio.
Thanks, Mark.
And all four of you.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, everyone. Take care now.
We're going to break here with Vito's Waltz from the soundtrack of The Godfather. It was composed by Nina Rota, who passed away on this day in 1979. We'll be right back, and when we come back, we are going to talk about what is going on with the battles around midwives and their right to deliver babies at home. Stay with us. We'll be right back.